I just love the book. The last time we talked, you were doing the one-man show, and now yeah. we've got a book.
Book came out of the show.
This might be the only. Is this the only good thing to come out of COVID? Is your book?
So far, yeah. But the good thing is we got it and got rid of it. You know, we knocked it out with pills, but there's still a little. It always keeps lingering on. You know, a little bit of COVID. You have a congestion in your head, you know.
I just got it before Christmas. I dodged it for all those years and got it about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, we dodged it, and then we got it at Thanksgiving. We never had it before.
Yeah. And we don't want it again.
No, absolutely not. Well, I love the book so much, and it's great, Paul, to learn about your background, too, and your upbringing. And as you point out in the book, it's safe to say that you did not inherit your sense of humor.
No, not from my folks. Once my mother said something funny, and I felt like writing her a check. I was 15. Remember that when I said, I've heard we have Indian blood. She said, that's what I hear. And I say, how much Indian blood do you have? She said, about a quart. At 15, I knew that was a good joke. That was about the only one she did. My dad never said anything funny.
Well, he was a hardworking man. You didn't realize until you were older everything that went into what he had done in building your family yeah. house basically from scratch.
Yeah. And I thought you know how you are when you're a kid, you thought everybody built his own house. I had no idea that was a big feat. My analyst explained it to me. He said he probably was high IQ. I'm wondering how, when he had bad eyes, he can see a quarter of an inch and build a cabinet and make it plumb. But he did it.
Something early in your life that you recount in the book struck me, because when I was about maybe 8 or 9, I had a little crush on my teacher, a Miss Ziegler, and we came back from Christmas vacation, and now she was Mrs. Papadopoulos. And I maybe the same thing happened with you and Miss Meadows.
Yes. And she was great. She was actually kind of tall, like, you know, maybe 5'11" or something, for an average woman. That was a little tall, and she looked like Jane Russell. You know, she was really really built, curvy lady. And because I was the only boy in the home ec class, studying baking and all that stuff. I kidded myself that because she gave me a lot of attention as the only boy, and I thought she was in love with me. And imagine my surprise when she married somebody. Never got over it.
Was it in high school, Paul, when your friend Jim introduced you to Buster Keaton and really the whole world of silent films?
That's right. I was 15. He was a rich kid. His father owned a Greek restaurant. And so they were well off. I wasn't. But we had great similar interests. But I didn't know there was such a thing as mentor, but that's what it was. He just, he saw I had similar interest in things, you know, like theater and comedy and all that stuff. And we used to make our own silent movies. And they weren't very good, but they were fast. Undercranked, you know. He had a little 8mm camera, and you could turn it on to a different speed. So we had made it go jerky, herky-jerky, like they used to look. That was him. In the beginning of films, even when it was early in France, the idea that it could go fast, everybody liked the idea that you wouldn't just see someone walking down the street, but they're like, you know, very, very fast. And that's what all silent movies kind of look like. Different speed of the camera.
You mentioned in the book, and you mentioned it in interviews, I think when we talked with you last time, too, that you identified with Keaton because he was an everyman, and you could see yourself in his shoes in those circumstances.
Yeah, his flat shoes, slap shoes, they used to call it. When I made those silent movies with Jim, I had read somewhere that they took the heels off their shoes for some reason, all those comics. even in vaudeville, it somehow made them funnier, they thought, that they had no heels on the shoe. And so I got a pair of shoes at an Army Navy store, high button, they were very high topped, took the heels off because that could be funny. Slap shoes, that's what they called them.
And you got to work with Keaton years later doing a commercial.
Yeah, it was. I was thrilled to death. And I played a Keystone Cop.
With, who was it, Chuck McCann, who was in that commercial too? There were some other pretty well-known actors who were in that
There was a guy named Barney Martin who became Seinfeld's father, Barney Martin. I'll tell you a quick story about Barney Martin. He was a New York City cop. And his beat was the back door, the stage door of the Ed Sullivan Theater. And he just sort of protected the guests coming in and out that it wouldn't be overcome by the people who wanted their autograph. All right, hold it. Hold it, folks. Give them a break and maybe sign one autograph and leave. But it was a busy corner. And he got to know the people inside, you know, the staff and all that, just because he was at the door. And at one point they said, you look like you could be a good comedian yourself, because he had a personality. So, well, I always admired those people, but I never had any jobs like that. They said, would you mind coming in and understudy and stand in for Jackie Gleason? Because Jackie didn't want to rehearse. Right. And he really read the script once and knew it. He had that kind of an instant. He knew all the lines. And he used to do the rehearsals because Audrey Meadows and Art Carney needed it. They needed their lines so they could bail out Gleason from time to time. And you could see it if you watch Gleason once in a while. The way he would get around it, if he didn't quite know the next line, to say, oh, I'm going to the Chicago. Chicago, you know who's going to Chicago? I'm going to Chicago. You're going to see me out there in Chicago. Then somebody else came in. I could see it when I watched him. But it was great. And, of course, I got to know Carney when I did The Odd Couple.
Right. Did you read the Dana Stevens book on on Keaton?
That was great. I read every book. In almost 1 month's time, the Dana Stevens and another book on Keaton came out.
Right, right.
And they were the most two thorough books. I've read a dozen books. But if you read a dozen, they all have the same information. Mm. It's all maybe movies he made and almost nothing new in most of them. But I own all of them. And somebody opened a museum in Palm Springs called the Museum of American Humor. So I gave them all my books. I still have the one that Buster signed. It was the one he supposedly wrote, My Wonderful World of Slapstick. And he said, to Paul with love, Buster Keaton.
I still have it right
in my bookcase.
You say that he in many ways became a surrogate father for you. Was it that combination of his stone-faced persona and your dad's inability to show emotion that led you to, I think you've called it, to underplay a lot of your acting?
As a kid, of course, I made my father my role model. And if he didn't smile, I didn't smile. Mm. So I kind of acted the way I grew up the way I did because the way he was. I was a little bit of a version of him. And almost all the parts I played, there's a little bit of him in there. A lot of times I have those grumpy fathers. And even when I'm insulting my son and breaking away, get him out of here. You know,
but you write very, very poignantly about that and how you realized in shooting that emotional scene with Dennis Christopher that it was you like playing your dad.
And who was my dad hugging? It had to be me.
Yeah,
it's quite an interesting thing there in that scene. It's full of emotion, easy to play.
You write very openly, Paul, about what therapy has done for you over the years.
Yeah.
Was that hard for somebody with your upbringing to walk into that for the first time?
Well, I probably didn't start therapy. I'd already been in New York about almost 10 years. But that, and when I got married, this woman said to me, maybe we should go into therapy. We weren't even having any emotional problems, but I think she sensed something that we weren't clicking or something. There's something hidden, you know. I said, sure, if you want to, but I had no idea. I didn't understand even why I might want to. But because she suggested, we both went into analysis. And the doctor we met with said, well, I'll handle one of you, but I'll have a recommendation for a colleague. And I was with my guy for a long, long time because I'd go out of town to do jobs, come back and go right back into it. But she kept firing her analysts. And I thought that when he got close to the truth, she fired him and she walked out. When you got into something delicate that she couldn't talk about, something.
We're talking with Paul Dooley here on Downtown. Was it doing the Three Penny Opera when you became Paul Dooley?
Yeah, just before we opened it, I found there's an actor on Broadway named Paul Brown, my original name. And of course, the union equity wouldn't allow you to use the name of an actor in the union before you. That's why Michael J. Fox was a J in there.
Right.
That's, you see an initial somewhere, that's what that was, you know.
You did a short-lived but a wonderful TV show in the early 60s with a couple of friends of ours, The Entertainers, with our friend John Davidson and a dear friend of our show. And when I told her you were going to be coming on, she was so excited, the wonderful Treva Silverman.
Of course, I know her well. And just this very day, a half an hour ago, I'm boxing up my new book and sending it to her.
Oh, that's wonderful.
She lives out here. And she came out here to do The Monkees. She's a writer. And then she did Mary Tyler Moore, one of the first, first two or three seasons. And she did a Dean Martin show and worked on it. Shows where she's writing sketches, basically.
All right. Treva said, I need to ask you to do some of that West Virginia accent that you worked so hard to get rid of.
Well, I'll give you a sample of what kind of words they use. A bush was called a boosh, and a dish was called a deesh, and a flat tire would be a flat tar. And I got a job in a factory, and they said, go see Shorty Wilson. I said, who's Shorty Wilson? He's the guy who hars and bars. So he was helping the personnel manager. But it's a funny, I don't hear it anywhere. Like, it isn't in Kentucky, it's not in Pennsylvania, but all around it or other. But Johnny Winters comes closest. He's a little ways over around Cincinnati from where I was born. And when he does his characters, they sound like a little like West Virginia. We're church people.
And at West Virginia, one of your classmates, he was a few years older than you, was the very talented Don Knotts. And you guys did some work
together.
Right.
But that was, college. Yeah. He lived there. That's his hometown. They have a Don Knotts Boulevard there. Don was losing his sight near the end. And Peter Marshall, who I think came from West Virginia too, set up a luncheon. I thought it was me and him. And I got there and it was me and him and Don Knotts. And Don came in and he couldn't see well. He was led by a pretty girl who was his associate girlfriend or his helper. But he sat down at the table and he said, pay no attention to her. She's my seeing eye girlfriend. And she was about 25 years younger. And she ate with us and Peter Marshall. We were about six people. And we knew he doesn't see well. But at the end, when they brought the check, he said, let me get that. But he put his hands all over the place, reaching for it and never knowing where it was, making a joke out of his blindness. But I thought it was great. Very funny.
Oh, he's great.
I remember he was a ventriloquist when he was 13. And once he showed me the dummy, took out of the attic and showed me a little bit of the act when he was an adolescent. And the dummy and Don had the same voice. Hello, Bobby. Hi, Don. He just had the one voice. I used to call him up and say, he'd say, hello. And I'd say, Kay, it's Paul Dooley. Is Don there? This is Don. Every time I called his house, I would get that.
You did some work.
He always had that high voice.
You did some work as a clown. I love the story in the book that it was an interesting transaction. You had loaned a clown costume to Alan Alda, and then later on, he helped you work on a routine for The Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
That's right. And he's a great guy, one of the nicest people I ever met in show business. You meet a lot of people, but he's really, truly a wonderful human being.
you had such great success doing commercials for many, many years. And not
sort
just
of sidetracked me from caring about plays and TV shows, because most of the TV shows had already moved to California. It was a big wave when they all went out to California. And not too much, except later when the Cosby shows were down there. But there was a whole dearth of television shows that were made in New York. But I didn't mind. I mean, hell, I was a hit in the commercial business. I did, you know, in a year I might have 30 TV commercials on camera with my face, and everybody saw me. So I became well known on television commercials, and they lasted 60 seconds.
I love going on your website and seeing the commercial that I remember from when it first came out. I hadn't seen in years, the wonderful Salada tea commercial.
That's great. I got a prize that year as the spokesman of the year. And you read in the book, of course, Alan Alda and I were vying for the same commercial.
Right.
they taped us both, and then they decided who to use. And I got the commercial, so out of tea, and he got mashed, but I'm not bitter.
You got to go on Broadway. Mike Nichols had seen you doing improv work and decided to make you a part of the cast of The Odd Couple. And you ended up not just playing one of the poker players, but you filled in a lot for Art Carney.
I did. I became his understudy. And both he and Matthau had understudies. And I went on, you know, 30 times or something. And the guy when I studied math, though, never went on once. He was as strong as a bull. He never missed a show. And Louis Zorich was his name. Yeah.
And Matthau had a tendency to milk it a little bit at times. And you kind of stood up to him when you were stepping in for Art Carney as Felix.
Yeah, I did. The stage manager said, the morale of the company is not good. I hear people ad-libbing. I hear people making up things, cutting lines, overlapping, you know, stealing each other's timing. I says, because Walter's screwing up the play every night. And that was like the elephant in the room, and none of the other people backed me up. But I just told the truth. He was a bit selfish, that's all.
Well, and he had that, I think I heard you talk about this in an interview. He had that presentational style that maybe owed something to the Yiddish theater, that he would make these declarations out of his lines sometimes.
That's right. When he was 15, I think in Yiddish, he did the Jewish theater, you know, down on Second Avenue. I had heard about it in one of his interviews. And he did had a bit of a grandiose style, you know, but he was described in a book that a man wrote about Art Carney as a hangdog look. But, you know, the part of Oscar is written much better to get laughs than Felix. The jokes he gave him, real jokes, Neil Simon did. He said, Felix wears his seatbelt in the drive-in movie. And they were all jokes. But all the jokes for Felix, the Carney role, were situational and, you know, character. They weren't really jokes that you'd tell out. You couldn't tell them outside the play and somebody would laugh. They had to be dependent on them. So like situation comedy is called sitcoms because the lines only work with the situation, not in real life, you know.
I was so happy in reading the book. I work with high school actors, and just this past spring, for a one-act play competition, I directed Elaine May's adaptation, which you starred in.
Yes, that was wonderful. Of course, I loved Mike and Elaine before I ever met them. And I got to work for both Mike and Elaine as directors. And adaptation was the star of it. There were four actors. Was Gabriel Dell, who was one of the original Dead End kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Gabe Dell. And I played every man he ever met in his life. And he played a game board as his life on the floor. It was like Monopoly. You have just failed adolescence. You have failed puberty. Go back two spaces. That was typical of her writing.
That's a wonderful show.
What a wonderful woman she was to work with, you know. Just the two of them are like gods to me. But anybody, most people think of them that way. The best improvisers ever. The best witty person ever. They had their own Broadway show, two-person show. But I was thrilled to be able to work with them. And also, I worked with kind of the original Second City gang when they came to New York, and I met Alan Arkin. I just sent him a book today. Well, I was sending out some books package.
That was a great group, too. It was Arkin. It was Paul Sand. Barbara Harris was part of that New York entourage.
Yeah, they had been a big deal in New York. A big deal in Chicago, and they came to New York. First, they did it on Broadway for 3 months, and they moved to a cabaret in Greenwich Village. But it also included a guy named Severin Darden, who's a hero to anybody who knows the history of a very kind of a madman comedian. It's a very interesting guy. And Paul Sand, of course. Richard Libertini was a favorite. I worked with him as well.
What led the people at the Children's Television Workshop to reach out to you? Was it because of your commercial work or acting? What drew them to Paul Dooley?
I wasn't sure, but when I got a call, they said it's the Children's Television Workshop, and I knew that was Sesame Street. And I thought maybe they might want me to do a voiceover for Sesame Street because I was just known for the commercials. Why were they calling me? I'm not a Muppet. So I got there, and there were other... It's a whole group of actors, a whole group of writers, and there was no show yet. They had no name, no title, no cast, nothing but finding ways to teach kids maybe to learn to read, really getting started off because you can't do it all, but you might get them interested because we use comedy to pull them in, you know. And we were trying to reach inner city kids. That's why they had Cosby and Rita Moreno as the stars. But I always... I'm a punster, and right away I started naming characters who were basically puns, like Fargo North, Decoder, Child Chef Julia Grona. And I made about 6 or 8 of these, and they stood out more than what the other guys were trying to write. A little of it lame, like having two flowers talking, trying to teach you reading. But they were looking, most kids' shows could look down on the kids. I was writing a course of my own personality, my own level of humor. And it was more satire and more wit. But the reader, right away, they realized I should be the guy in charge. So I created a lot of other characters. And Morgan Freeman was there playing Easy Reader, based on Easy Rider. And there was a lot of stuff. I had an idea for a scene where a gorilla is being taught to read. And by Judy Grobart, I cast her because she's Second City. And she's grown up, but she has a childlike quality. And I cast all those actors, really. They had a lot of faith in me, these people, because they wanted me to direct sketches and be in the show and write it.
Well, and you put in so much time. A year of that was enough, because what was it, well over 130 episodes?
Yeah, that was the season. Was 130. That's probably 9 months. There used to be a standard thing. There used to be 36 episodes. It was a season. Then it became 26. Mm. But it's all based on the idea that in vaudeville and in legit theaters, there was no air conditioning up until a certain point. So when the spring came, they closed down vaudeville theaters, and people went to the beach, or they went swimming, or they stayed home, or went out on picnics. So because of no air conditioning, the legit theaters in vaudeville closed down. And that's why that season, even on Broadway closed down too. So the Broadway season is from September, and then in April or May, they closed down in the old days because of air conditioning. Sometimes you used to put giant pieces of ice in the back with a fan behind them as an air conditioner. But the fan drowned out the actors. Now it's still called the season, you know.
Right.
Opening a show in the summer is not as likely to get an audience as during the basic season. But all very interesting. But for some reason, I was in love with vaudeville as well as silent movies. Somehow, I really kind of believe maybe I was born at another time. Because why am I loving Buster Keaton like he's God. And why do I love Vaudeville? And of course, it's partly because that's where he came from.
Right, right. Breaking Away was such a career-defining role for you in many ways. Did you know that there was magic there when you first read the script for Breaking Away?
I did, because I never had an audition where I could tell just from 3 or 4 pages, this guy knows how to make things funny. And that was Steve Tesich. He won the Oscar for it. He died a little too early. He was in his 40s. Mm. But I knew from reading first of all, I knew it was my dad would be an easy way to play it, you know, kind of cranky a little bit. I made him even more cranky than my real dad. But boy, the writing was incredible. I'll give you an example. My first scene, I have a fly swatter. I'm at breakfast, I'm killing flies. He comes in wearing perfume. And I said, what is that? And my wife says, oh, it's Neapolitan sunset. He likes the smell. And I said, well, the flies seem to like it. I got a laugh by saying anything. Tell him to take a shower. I could have got a laugh on that. 9 things could have been funny. But the idea of bringing it back, the flies seem to like it.
Did they know you spoke Italian?
No, they didn't. But that was I loved Italian. I learned it and I got A's. I just kept taking it more courses because I got A's. I have a good ear for sound and for voices. And I finally had eight semesters. So I had a minor in a language I was never going to use. Because when you leave home, you don't encounter other Italians. You're not going to exactly remember. I can speak restaurant Italian.
Paul's book is called Movie Dad, Finding Myself and My Family on Screen and Off. And along with talking about your career, there is the very powerful story of what happened when you lost your kids, became separated from them for a while, and how that informed not just your acting, but obviously impacted your life. And that's such an incredible story of how you were able to find them.
Not only normal, regular people, but every parent could really empathize with what that would mean, just lose them like that, just gone. You know, what's going to happen to them? If they ever got sick, I'm never going to know about it. It was just incredible. But I don't know, I just persevered through it, but it was a real devastation for me. And I use it in my work when I can, when I need to. If I'm playing some kind of a part where there's a dramatic end of it. But I played a lot of fathers who are humorous and fathers who are serious. But I've done about 25 fathers. And I thought the hook of the book, if you will, the thing that would interest publishers, is the irony of not having kids and becoming known as a movie dad. It's like it was such a left-handed kind of thing. Of all people, I'm going to be the dad because I've lost control of being a dad to my own kids.
There's a wonderful story in the making of 16 Candles about one scene that Molly Ringwald's mother was pretty uncomfortable with and the adjustment that you made that worked so well.
I rewrote a line that the first one was too bawdy. He said, the script says he pats his daughter on her behind. Where are your panties? Well, how are you going to know that? And why are you patting her on the behind? So I wrote another line, which is harmless, but it got us to the right point. You make sure you wear the pants in the family. And the next shot is a kid holding up the pants. Anthony Michael Hall.
The woman whose name is up here on my screen, how did that change your life when you and Winnie got together?
Well, first of all, I, like a lot of people, I suppose, I was in a couple of marriages where unconsciously, more or less, I wasn't committed. You know, I got into a relationship and we got married, but I was never really in love, you know, and said that's never a good start. So that's going to fall apart at some time. But I met her in an improvisational company and we were... at first, I just admired her because she was a good writer, a good improviser, a good actress, And she could have been my daughter. She's 26 years younger. But I was attracted to her brain and her talent and her personality because she's very charming. And there's almost nobody that doesn't like my wife. Maybe Will Rogers, I don't know. No, he said, I never met a man I didn't like.
Right now, I was 55. I was 55 when I had my son, my first. How old were you when Savannah was born?
I think about 58.
Oh, yeah, 50.
I think about
middle 50s.
Yeah, like 57 or so.
Yeah, I kind of forget it.
She was born in 80. We're not good at math. She was born in 85.
85, which would make me what? I don't know. Somewhere in my 50s.
Yeah. Well, I found out I didn't have kids before I had my son at that age, but certainly I've reached a level of maturity that has allowed me to be, I think, a better dad than I would have been if we had had him in my 30s or 20s, certainly.
And I bet you worried at that age, having a son, is where would you be when he was grown up or when he was 20, let's say. I worried about that.
Oh,
that
yeah.
About the time I'm going to kick the bucket, that my daughter might have been just in high school and I'd leave her without a father. It turns out I'm living as old as Methuselah and 94 now. So she's grown up. She's in her late 30s. But it all worked out. But we really, out of an admiration, really, for her talents, but after a few months, we were in love and couldn't stay away from each other and got married.
And how much of her success, now I know the answer to this, I'm just kidding, but I her success must directly go to that hut that you built for her to do her writing in.
I think if it wasn't for the lumber, I don't know where she'd be. No, it's a little building in our backyard. It's 14 by 14. It's not that I'm Arthur Miller and I actually built it. He did that. And he wrote Death of a Salesman there, a little cabin in the woods. But it was really the time when she said, I'd like to have a place to write where I wasn't bothered by the phones all the time. Now she's on the phone every minute. But she would go out to this little place that didn't have a phone, and they were more isolated, more free to write. But
you always encouraged me. That's the real truth.
She says I encouraged her. That was her real secret. But
yeah, you did.
Well, and you've written and performed together. I watched a wonderful video of your take on Love Letters that everybody in the world has performed, but you guys did it with Post-it notes, and it was brilliant.
Yeah, it is good. It's a really funny, what is it? It's even 10 minutes, probably
about 15 minutes.
No, it's extremely well written, and because you don't have to learn the lines, you can just read it, because it's a reading thing. And it doesn't have too many scenery. Two chairs will do it, maybe a couple of little small tables. And I wrote in the front of the book, I said, take one Post-it and another and turn them upside down and stick them together, and then they won't be sticky when you pick them up. There'll be one Post-it. But it's been done over 100 times easily because, you know, it's easy to do and it's also extremely good.
Well, it's wonderful.
Touching ending.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I loved it. A little bit of physical comedy too, a little perhaps homage to some of those inspirations at the beginning when you two are waiting to take your seats.
Yeah, that was definitely Paul's idea.
Oh yeah, she looks at me like, will you pull out my chair? I pull out her chair, she sits down, I go to my chair and look over there, and she has to come back and pull my chair out. That was the bit we put in.
Well, the book is
we call it the Junior Wicked. It just keeps plowing along, you know, cause that we get a dollar when they sell a $10 book of it, and many people buy it and don't do it. They're looking around. But we make something like $35 if they perform it. So it's a little engine that could. It just keeps rewarding us in small ways.
Well, it's wonderful.
But we love that piece. It's really a wonderful piece.
Well, I enjoyed reading your book so much. It's called Movie Dad, Finding Myself and My Family, on screen and off. It's a story of a remarkable career and a pretty amazing life that we hope just keeps going on and on and on. Paul, it's wonderful to talk with you again. And Winnie, nice to talk with you from a distance as well.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you.
I try to keep her at a distance. Yeah. She's on the end of the couch and I'm over here. No, anyway, she's always plugging in. She reminds me of things when I'm talking on a Zoom. She's like a junior Zoomer.
Well, we appreciate both of you making some time for us today. Congratulations. Good luck on the book.
Thank
you. Hope the new year brings you continued good health and happiness to both of you.
Yeah.
Thank you. You too.
And we hope show business comes back.
That would be nice too. Absolutely. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.